Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Iran, A Modern History, by Abbas Amanat, narrated by Derek Perkins. Preface. Covering half a millennium of history of any country or region is a formidable task. When it comes to the history of early modern and modern Iran, it becomes daunting. It took nearly two decades for me to try to cover a complex period that witnessed five dynastic changes, at least three revolutions, three civil wars, four episodes of foreign occupation, and the inception of a new Islamic government. I hope I have produced a coherent narrative that threads the events of this past into meaningful themes, just as every knot feeds into the larger pattern of a Persian carpet. Yet history, as historians are anxious to caution their listeners, has many random twists and turns which seldom lend themselves to an orderly design. What emerges, as in this book, may seem to be disarray up close, but from afar, with the benefit of hindsight, it reveals a pattern with many discernible paths. I have tried in this book to trace the roots of Iranian modernity, or more accurately, modernities, over a half millennium. To many readers, the rise of a potent messianic movement five centuries ago may seem a far cry from any notion of modernity, at least the way it is often understood. Yet there is in fact a relationship between the rise of a state with an enforced religious creed, in this case the Safavid Empire upholding Shi'ism, and emergence of a modern nation-state in later centuries. Encounters with Europe in the 19th and the 20th centuries, and the adoption of Western-style modernity in all its permutations, only reinforced Iran's own sense of identity and its distinct pattern of continuity. Despite territorial losses at the periphery and its inherent material disadvantages, Iran was among very few non-Western countries that preserved its sovereignty and much of its territorial integrity in the age of high imperialism. It did so, it can be argued, in part because it rendered, and still is rendering, its own Persianized version of modernity, not without many trials and errors. In this book, by and large, I have respected a dynastic periodization, not only because changes of dynasties mattered in and of themselves, but also because many times they were emblematic of socio-political, economic, and cultural shifts. Emphasis on members of the elite I also deemed inevitable, for such personalities often proved agents of important and, at times, disastrous changes. Understanding personality traits of Ismail I and Abbas I of the Safavid dynasty were as crucial in the shaping of modern Iran as were those of Aka Muhammad Khan Qajar, Reza Shah Pahlavi, and, more recently, Ayatollah Khomeini. Yet, invariably, I have tried to balance these political and biographical narratives with attention to socio-economic and cultural trends. Likewise, I have tried, to the extent possible, to locate the Iranian past in broader regional landscapes. This is as much an effort to examine Iranian history inclusively or to deter perceptions of exceptionalism as it is an effort to display the vibrant bonds that tied Iran to both neighboring lands and prevailing global trends. Yet I resisted globalizing the Iranian past beyond reasonable limits. We cannot ignore shared patterns that tie Iran to its neighboring lands, nor can we deny the dictates of geography, religion, and political culture that set Iran apart from South Asia and from Central Asia, Anatolia, Mesopotamia, or Arabia. The book consists of an introduction, four parts, and an epilogue. Part 1, 1501 to 1797, covers the early modern era, from the rise and then shaping of the Safavid Empire to the end of the 18th century. Part 2, 1797 to 1911, covers the long 19th century, from the consolidation of the Qajar dynasty and encounters with European powers to the constitutional revolution at the turn of the 20th century. Part 3, 1914 to 1977, covers developments from World War I and its aftermath to the end of the Pahlavi era. Part 4, 1977 to 1989, is devoted to the shaping of the Islamic Revolution during its first phase. In this final part, wherever I deemed it necessary, I have made brief observations about the post-1989 period in the hope of bringing the narrative to a close. I tried to strike a balance between early modern and modern periods, even though in practice about two-thirds of the book is devoted to the 20th century, given the weight of the events between the Constitutional Revolution and the Islamic Revolution. Attention to long-term themes also helped determine the book's size and organization. I strived to trace overarching themes and articulate arguments while still preserving a narrative. The famous verse by the Persian poet Rumi often echoed in my mind, "The secret of the beloved is best to be told in the stories of the others." The reader will notice throughout such recognized and stubborn themes as natural resources and the limits of human habitat, the tension between the sedentary center and the nomadic periphery, the interplay between the state and the urban elite, including the clerical establishment, tension between rulers and ministers, the chronic resurgence of alternative socio-religious movements, and the persistence of cultural and artistic memories. In the 19th and 20th centuries, a greater engagement with European imperial powers, greater awareness of material weaknesses, dilemmas of reform and development, the ideal and realities involved in becoming modern, evolving notions of national identity, and the mastery of internal economic resources all loomed large. Finally, greater reliance on exportable natural resources helped the state consolidate and further its modernizing project. Yet, over time, an autocratic vision of transforming Iran lost its popular mandate, generated nostalgia for a fast-disappearing world, and fostered a revolutionary aptitude with strong Islamic undercurrents. There are topics and personalities that are absent from this book, or appear in passing, and others who take up perhaps more than their fair share. Men, far more than women, dominate this narrative. Rewriting an essentially patriarchal history is formidable, if not at times impossible. The same can also be said about the silenced multitudes of the downtrodden, the marginalized, the nonconformists, and the powerless in a master narrative, often penned by agents of political power and compilers of hagiographies. I have tried, nevertheless, to retrieve some of these voices and incorporate them into my story. In retrospect, debates about gender and ethnicity, everyday life, popular culture, public and private spheres, ecology and environment, and complexities of cultural identities could have received greater attention. Yet I hope I have shown at least historical glimpses of a society and a culture more diverse and more complex than often appear in monolithic and monotonous accounts of Iran. Reference to poetry and literary trends, for instance, is one way to enrich our understanding of those recesses of collective memory that the official narrative often ignores or denies. These are the contours of a collective memory that connects the Safavid times to the Qajar era, and to the Constitutional Revolution and the rise of Pahlavi state, the national movement of the post-war era, and eventually to contemporary times. The presence of my own voice in the style and substance of this book is undeniable, and this is not foreign to those students of history who seek to strike a balance between historical objectivity and the deeper traits of authorial subjectivity. What can playfully be called history with attitude does not aim to unfairly interrogate the past or pass ahistorical judgments, but instead to raise critical questions, to problematize the conventional wisdom, and perhaps to render some uninhibited, though subtle, answers. As a child of a generation who witnessed an age of heady Westernism and the furious responses to it, that is, the latter decades of the Pahlavi era and the dawn of the Islamic Revolution, I find it almost imperative to address problematiques that were crucial and still are to the shaping of Iran and the rest of the Middle East. Frustrated struggles for democracy and tolerance, the transforming face of nationalism, the rise and fall of autocratic regimes, disillusionment with ideologies, and, of course, contentious grappling with Western powers and a globalizing culture. At the end of many years, one afterthought may best sum up these feelings. A sorrowful stroll in the Garden of Memories, as the poet Farrukh Farrukhzad has it. Introduction. Long before Iran came to be known in the mid-20th century as one of the countries of the Middle East, for nearly 2.5 millennia it was known to the Western world as Persia. An ancient land in Western Asia, it is strategically located between the Indian subcontinent, Central Asia and China to its east, Mesopotamia and the Mediterranean world to its west, Russia to the north, and the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Peninsula to its south. At the crossroads of two major trade routes, the Silk Road, passing through northern and central Iran, and the so-called Spice Route, from South Asia through the Persian Gulf. For many centuries, Iran, as a regional empire, was fertile ground for cultural, commercial, and population exchanges with its neighbours. As early as the 2nd millennium BC, when the Indo-European pastoralists first entered the Iranian plateau, and as late as the 20th century, Iran was host to a diverse ethnic, cultural, and linguistic population, either through conquest or through peaceful settlement. Despite prolonged political lapses, for 2.5 millennia, Iran remained a cultural entity distinguished by its indigenous characteristics and recognized as such by the world around it. Since the early 16th century, when the Safavid state came into being, Iran has maintained an uninterrupted political identity. For most of the period up to the mid-7th century, when the Sasanian Empire fell to the conquering Arab armies of Islam, Iran, or more accurately the Persian Empire, managed to outlive as a political community a number of its rivals to the west, starting with the Greeks and continuing with the Romans and then the Byzantine Empire of late antiquity. This despite devastating defeats, nomadic invasions, ethnic hegemonies, changes in its religious identity, and recurring domestic upheavals. Iran is perhaps one of the most invaded and most revolution-prone countries in world history, a debatable merit with lasting consequences. In between the Islamic conquest and the rise of the Safavid state, Iran survived more as a cultural than a unified political entity, in part because of geography and ecology, but also because of the prevalence of the Persian language and high culture. In adopting the Arabic script in the early 9th century, Iran preserved much of its key cultural paradigms, myths, and memories. The Perso-Islamic Renaissance that occurred soon thereafter in the 11th century, and long remained at the heart of Muslim cultural efflorescence, helped shape Iran's cultural identity. Yet, classical Persian language coexisted with a wide range of other languages and dialects, regional cultures, and customs and ethnicities within and beyond Iran proper. The Persianate world, as Marshall Hodgson, the historian of Islamic civilization, called it, stretched throughout eastern Islamic lands, from Central Asia and Xinjiang, Khotan in Persian, to Hindustan and spread from the Caucasus, Anatolia, today's Asian Turkey, and the southern Balkans to Mesopotamia. Memories of an ancient past. The Persians, and before them the Medes, were among the first people known to the ancient Greeks outside their own geographic sphere. As early as the 6th century BC, when Cyrus the Great, the founder of the Achaemenid Empire, approximately 550 BC to 330 BC, conquered Asia Minor, the Persians came to occupy in the Greek mind the place of a formidable other. For more than 2 centuries, the Persians inspired in the Greek imagination a mixture of awe and fear toward an imperial power, which, in contrast to the vulnerable Greek city-states, was based on a centralized state and ruled by the King of Kings. It was admired as a vast multinational empire with legendary wealth and economic power, universal currency, as well as an efficient administration, army, and communication. Long-distance carriage roads and horse couriers, rather than barefoot runners. It had a belief system totally different from that of the Greeks' own quarrelling Olympian deities. Herodotus, himself a Greek subject of the Persian Empire, living in Asia Minor, embarked on the Histories, with the chief aim of answering one major question. How was the only superpower of his time, the empire of Cyrus and Darius, resisted and eventually defeated in the Persian Wars, 499 BC to 449 BC, by the seemingly vulnerable Greeks? His flattering answer, a blend of fact and fiction, greatly influenced ancient historical consciousness and even helped shape Western ambivalence toward Iran in modern times. the Greeks called this civilization barbarian, barbaros, which in the original sense of the term meant alien, or more specifically, a person who mumbles, presumably because the Greeks could not understand the languages of Iran, whether ancient Persian or Aramaic. The term implied Persian inferiority to the Greek and later Roman sense of superiority. Such a condescending attitude was a predictable reaction, one could argue, to the Greeks' fear of succumbing in real life to the Persians and their material superiority. Aeschylus's The Persians, the first surviving Greek historical tragedy, written by a soldier who himself had fought in the Persian Wars, celebrated the Greek victory by imagining the impact of the devastating news of the Persian defeat in the war on the Persian royalty and the court, a clever ploy, no doubt reflective of the Greeks' jubilant mood at being saved from Persian hegemony. It was not an accident that the Athenian Parthenon, the architectural representation of a rare moment of Greek solidarity, was built to celebrate victory in the Persian Wars. As has been related, on the famous shield of Athena, whose huge statue was worshipped in the Parthenon, the Persians were depicted as barbarians clad in effeminate dress, about to be humbled by the masculine and victorious Greeks. In this case, Occidental artistic representation seems to have determined long ago its choice depiction of Persia as the Orient par excellence, feminine and exotic. Nor was it an accident that the chief target of Alexander's world-conquering ambition should have been the Persian Empire. The Macedonian adventurer, whom the Zoroastrian sources of pre-Islamic Iran labelled as Evil Alexander, no doubt exploited these anti-Persian sentiments, rampant among the Greeks of Asia Minor, as a pretext to reclaim Greek lands after more than two centuries under Persian rule. When Alexander conquered the Achaemenid Empire in 330 BC, he was too anxious, to the dismay of some of his generals, and against the advice of his teacher, Aristotle, who viewed the Persian state as tyrannical, not only to adopt Persian costumes and courtly manners, but also to create a universalistic Greco-Persian political hybrid. In this vision, as far as can be recovered from the Greek narratives, greater weight was given to the realities of the Persian model of government than to the Greek ideals. The Greek conquest nevertheless resulted in infusion of Hellenistic culture into the Iranian world that lasted for hundreds of years afterward and well into the Islamic era. Resonating through the early modern and modern centuries, the victory against the Persian Empire was celebrated in post-Enlightenment Europe and during the Western imperial expansion in the 19th century as a turning point in the history of Western civilization. For modern Europeans who rediscovered Persia, these memories were alive and hugely reinforced by the retrieval of classical texts, and later by archaeological findings in the Near East and in Iran. References in the Hebrew Bible were far more favourable to the Persians. Cyrus the Great, Hebrew Koresh, taken from the Old Persian, in particular, fared well. He was the Anointed One, Messiah, or Mashiach, who delivered the Israelites from their Babylonian captivity and allowed them to return to their homeland and later, under the Achaemenid successors, to rebuild their temple in Jerusalem. He was the only historical figure in the Hebrew Bible to be recognized as the Lord's Messiah and his shepherd, Isaiah verses 44 and 45, and one of the very few rulers to be praised for his tolerance and compassion. Furthermore, the story of the Book of Esther, whereby the Jewish concubine of the Persian King of Kings saves his co-religionists from massacre at the hands of a sinister minister, is largely a composite narrative pieced together to reassure the Jews of their ultimate redemption against later occurrences of anti-Semitism. It nonetheless demonstrates the Israelites' favourable attitude and loyalty toward their Persian overlords in exchange for Achaemenid royal protection. The positive attitude of the Bible toward the Persians may also be attributed to the affinity the Israelites felt between their own omniscient God and the Persian wise lord, the Ahura Mazda, of Iranian religion, and later of Zoroastrianism. Unlike the Babylonian deities, Ahura Mazda was compassionate and predictable, a supporter of the righteous and an enemy of the wicked. A distant memory of such an affinity can be seen in the Book of Daniel, which, though a composite product of later centuries, represented in its apocalyptic imagery a just and mighty Persian king of kings who redeems the saved and eliminates the damned, an image that may well have been coloured by the Zoroastrian apocalyptic tradition of Iran. As a political community, both Greek and Hebrew portrayals represented ancient Iran as an alternative space, as the land of the other, which should be dealt with on its own terms. To this extent, they were not far from the idea of Iran as a political community, a geopolitical entity with a centralized state and a dominant religion. The name Iran, as is often noted, is derived from the Iranian term Aryanam, the land of the Aryans, the branch of Indo-European pastoralists who settled in the Iranian plateau some 4,000 years ago and gave their name to the land. Although in our time Aryan has been besmirched beyond recovery, etymologically it implied something benign. Iran and its origin, as the brilliant French philologist Émile Benveniste has argued, essentially meant we who are next of kin, or we cousins, a term of kinship identification implying us, by which these pastoralists distinguished themselves, presumably, from the indigenous inhabitants of the plateau or from other Indo-Europeans. This sense of kinship solidarity is stressed in the Shahnameh, the great Persian epic of the 10th century, whereby the term Iran as a political community is contrasted with an Iran in Middle Persian, the non-Iranians or the aliens. Like other ancient nations who employed similar kinship terms for their homelands, Iran came to be the sole name by which Iranians signified their own land and their state. Iran as a cultural identity persisted through the Islamic period and later was fully revived in the 13th century by the great Persian ministers of the Ilkhanid dynasty. Ancient Greeks, and later their Western cultural heirs, however, continued to refer to Iran by the name of the original homeland of the prevailing Achaemenid Empire, the Greek Persica, or Perses, as well as the Hebrew Paras, was anglicized to Persia, a reference to the heartland of the Iranian plateau, the Pars region, and today's Fars province, from which the Achaemenid Persians rose to power and came to dominate the entire Iranian plateau and beyond. For many centuries, Persia was the name of the country to the outside world, and Persian a reference to its people, language, and culture, while the term Iran was consistently used by Iranians in reference to their country. It was only in 1935 that the Iranian government adopted Iran instead of Persia as the official name of the country, a choice that made uniform the nomenclature, but effectively obliterated beyond recovery the historical and cultural memory that the old name invoked. As in most ancient states, power in Persian political culture was primarily built on a patriarchal model, one that replicated itself at royal, regional, local, tribal, and family levels. In conjunction with the institution of kingship, but still separate from it, the clerical authority demanded that its followers comply with the legal interpretation of the sacred text, be it Zoroastrian law or Islamic Sharia. For most of the early modern and modern times, the ulama, the class of the learned, or more specifically the jurists, fabis, remained a semi-independent institution tangential to the authority of the state. Yet the clerical establishment, and even state power, was occasionally challenged by the prophetic paradigm, a third force in the Persian tripartite model of authority. Over the centuries, numerous such figures, from the 3rd century Morni and the 6th century Mazdak in the Sasanian era, to the 12th century Ismaili leader Hassan Sabah, the 14th century Noctavi prophet Mahmud Pasikhani, and the 19th century Sayyid Ali Muhammad the Bab, called for the reform of religious norms and eventually the prevailing socio-political order by means of moral reconstruction and, at times, apocalyptic revolution. It is the interplay of these three sources of authority that punctuates Iran's narrative: violent revolts, contested historical memories, religious paradoxes, norms of gender and social divide, but also cultural fluorescence and fluidity. Whether by design or accident, such a narrative of anguished and volatile complexity persisted over centuries. crucial to the rudiments of political authority in Iran, and perhaps the oldest in its political culture, is the idea of the Shah, the universal title for Iranian kings up to modern times. With no etymological equivalent in other Indo-European languages, Shah is of old Persian origin, Khashai, which basically means the one who deserves to rule on his own merit, which implies innate merit as the qualifying criterion for power. Rendered in Greek as Basiliokos, originally in reference to Persian kings, and Basileus Basilkos for King of Kings, the term Shah also implied autocratic independence from any priestly or other human legitimizing agency. This is depicted well, for example, in reliefs from the 3rd century CE of the investiture of Sasanian kings, who received their divine mandate directly from a deity and not from a Zoroastrian priest. In contrast to Rex in European languages and Raj in Sanskrit, both of which referred to rulers who were essentially priest-kings leading their people along the right path of religion, the Shah possessed kingly charisma, Fa or Fara. The royal charisma, radiating from the king's countenance, the term charisma in European languages probably is derived from the Persian Khore, sun ray, was divinely bestowed upon the ruler of the right quality, Persian Gohar, but it could be taken away from him if he lost the art of governing, in Persian Honar, a word of the same origin as honor. Deprived of charisma, the Shah would ultimately be deposed by popular revolt, dynastic contestants, or foreign invaders. The contingency of preserving the royal charisma thus served, at least in theory, as a tempering mechanism against tyranny. Despotic rulers who lose their charisma would not endure, as the prototypical example of mythical Jamshid in the Shahnameh reminded the historical rulers. At the outset, Jamshid is the founder of the cities, the teacher of new crafts, the initiator of the Persian Nowruz festival, and a great empire builder. But he loses his Fah because of his arrogance and self-glorification, failings that came with material power and despotic behavior. Western observers, from Aristotle to Montesquieu, were only too anxious to point to these pitfalls of Persian despotism, perhaps for reasons that had to do more with the threat of despotic rulers in their own societies than with the realities of Persian kingship. The Persian theory of government envisioned certain checks and balances to restrain the brute and unbridled exercise of power. A functional model of government, known as the circle of equity, was the ideal by which the manuals of government, a much revered genre in Persian political writing, reminded the rulers of their duty to administer justice. Essentially, the Shah was required to maintain social balance by honoring each constituency with its due protection and reward, by keeping at bay the army and the state administration, divan, so as to inhibit their oppressive intrusion into the life of the subjects. If the subjects are oppressed and plundered, so the circular model explains, they cannot produce and prosper, as a result of which the land will become impoverished and the state will be weakened, and eventually the ruler's power base will crumble and he will be deposed and destroyed. This cyclical model of power, inspired no doubt by the precariousness of the agrarian cycle in which it developed, seldom corresponded to the realities of power. The reality was more like the infinite complexity of a game of chess, from the Middle Persian Shatrang, from the original Sanskrit Chaturanga, with the Shah often in possession of checkmate, from the Persian Shahmat, itself a concept in chess that developed in the Persian environment when the game was first imported from India during late antiquity. The political symbolism of the game can hardly be missed. Few shahs over the long course of Iranian history managed to maintain the formidable balance of both the polity and society at large without being isolated to the point of checkmate. The analogy of chess as a discourse of moves and countermoves in Persian political culture, and the chessboard as the political arena, is further evident in the introduction to the game of another piece, Farzin, Persian for sage, and later minister, or vazir, which later was identified in the European version as the queen. The mobility and versatility of the minister or queen, including his or her revivification to the stage from the position of a negotiating pawn, as opposed to the Shah's isolated vulnerability, is a telling commentary on the hazards of ministerial office as head of the Divan. The uneasy collaboration for control of the government between insecure Shahs and shrewd chief ministers, singular Sadr-e-Azam, is a recurring theme in Iran's political history, with frequently fatal outcomes for the ministers. Fragile alliances within the Divan and maneuvering for privilege and influence, moreover, made it impossible for the ministerial institution to withstand the onslaughts of its royal master. Over the long term, the Divan never created an independent base free from royal intrusion, remaining instead the servant of the Shah and subject to his whims and wishes. Employing a chess analogy, the great Persian poet Hafez gives us the skeptic's ambivalence toward the institution of kingship and its volatile dependency on the minister's skilled manoeuvres. Waiting for the rook to make a move, we drive a pawn. On the skeptic's chessboard, there is no room for a king. When the endgame comes, a pawn, symbolizing the often humble origins of the ministers, still has a chance to turn into a minister or queen and change the fortunes of the game, depending on how the rook, from Persian rukh, perhaps a symbol of peripheral power, decides to move. Otherwise, the king has no future, for he is about to be checkmated. Center and periphery. Even when the structural deficiencies in the Persian model of government were to be overcome by the ruler or his ministers, there were marginal forces outside the state's immediate reach. Most prevalent, perhaps, were the tribal landlords, the Khans, on the periphery of the kingdom, who, taking advantage of the difficult Iranian terrain, resisted full control of the central authority. The expediency of coming to terms with peripheral powers, the rooks of Hafez's verse, was generally acknowledged by the Persian central government, which, instead of costly and often ineffective methods of direct rule, resorted to granting Khans of the periphery a semi-autonomous status. By allowing oversight through princely rule or other agencies, nurturing parallel leaderships within tribal confederacies, and using the dual means of persuasion and punishment, the state held sway over the geographical periphery. Iran's geographical realities hence determined its administrative structure, a legacy that lasted throughout pre-modern times and up to the beginning of the 20th century. In European languages, the terms satrap for provincial governor and satrapy for provincial administration are from the ancient Persian term for the protector of frontier dominion in the Achaemenid Empire, who acted as a semi-autonomous agent of the King of Kings. The term ustan, the provincial administrative unit of the Sasanian Empire, in contrast, became the standard suffix for all districts, the suffix stan, as in Uzbekistan, for example, and later sovereign states of the Persianate world from the Balkans and Caucasus to Central and South Asia. The delicate arrangement between the center and the periphery was at the core of the idea of the King of Kings, Shahanshah, a key notion in Persian political culture. Beyond the vainglory that was attached to the term, especially in the 20th century, the title of the King of Kings was an acknowledgement of a pyramid of power that made the imperial Shah of the Shahs superior to the guardian kings, the Padishahs, of the provincial divisions. Originally the title of the Persian imperial sovereign of antiquity, the King of Kings was revived both in Persian epic and court poetry, and as an official title of rulers of the Persian dynasties from the 10th century CE onward, and with even greater regularity from the Safavid period. The efficacy of guarding vulnerable frontiers through provincial agents prolonged the idea of a multinational system. The guarded domains of Iran, Mamolike Mahruseye Iran, which became the official title of the country, perhaps as early as the 13th century, implied decentralized autonomy and acknowledged diversity of cultures and ethnicities. The idea of the guarded domains implied the presence of contesting powers at the frontiers. In this notion of Iran, one may argue, there was a realistic recognition not only of its complexity, but also of the inherent necessity for the central state. The confines of sovereignty were expressed in another definitive term. The word Iran Shah, the official name of Iran proper in the Sasanian period, 224 to 651, reinforced the idea of Iran as a protected political entity dominated by the state and with a definite geographic space. The term Shah, the standard word in Persian for a walled city, etymologically denotes a domain within which the authority of the Shah is enforced. The Shah, in effect, is the centralized state as it crystallized within the space of the city, a concept close to that of the Greek polis. In the historical sense, it referred to the 10 provinces of Iran proper of the Sasanian period, through which the authority of the central government was directly enforced. The interplay between Iran Shah and its periphery generated a central theme in pre-20th century Iran and was a decisive force in shaping political authority even in the Islamic classical period, when the land of Iran became fragmented or was annexed to a larger Islamic empire. Caving under pressure, the crumbling central authority was overridden periodically by a new and more dynamic peripheral power. Since the first of the Turkic dynasties of Central Asia, who came to the Iranian plateau in the 10th century, for an entire millennium, nearly all dynastic states of Iran were originated in the nomadic periphery, or supported by it. Iran Shara as a physical space. The delicate interplay within the guarded domains finds a natural, almost ideal locale within the confines of Iran's geography. The high-altitude Iranian plateau in Western Asia serves as a natural four-cornered fortress, or a walled garden, as the Persian mythology of the Sasanian era imagined the Iran Shah, dominated by mountain ranges on its northern and western ridges and large bodies of water on its fringes. The contrast with the lowlands of Mesopotamia to the southwest and with Central Asia to the northeast is even more pronounced when we examine the dramatic topography of Iran's interior, or at its geological formation, diverse climates, limited rainfall, sparse vegetation, and clusters of human habitat. Decisive though they were in shaping Iran as a country, natural geography neither seriously hindered contact with the outside world, nor repulsed the conquering armies from Central Asian steppes or the interiors of Arabia. It did not stop the trade caravans coming from all directions either. The massive and seemingly impenetrable Zagros range, stretching from the northwest to the southeast of today's Iran, separated the heartlands of the Iranian world from Mesopotamia and beyond, and historically functioned as Iran's natural defense line. Significant chasms throughout the Zagros system, however, allowed not only the passage of victorious Arab armies of Islam in the 7th century, but also major incursions by the Ottoman armies in early modern times, and most recently, the Iraqi invasion of 1980 to 1983. The high-altitude Elburz range, part of a mountain system stretching from the Alps to the Himalayas, extends from northwestern Iran to northern Khorasan, eventually linking to the Hindu Kush range in Afghanistan. Iran's most serious geostrategic weakness, however, was the passageway into the plains of Central Asia, through which waves of Turkic and Mongolian hordes swept through since the 11th century. The profound impact of these nomadic invasions, which continued in one form or another up to the end of the 18th century, is notable in virtually all aspects of Iran's history and ethnicity. The prevalence of Azerbaijani Turkish and other Turkic dialects in northern Iran is but one indication. The Caucasus and the Elburz ranges, stretching across Azerbaijan and the lush but impenetrable mountain barrier on the Caspian shores, however, proved a more formidable defense against the northern threat. These natural barriers were overcome only in the 19th century by Russia's modern armies. Similarly, the coasts of the Persian Gulf never posed a serious strategic threat to the Iranian interior before the arrival of the Portuguese in the 15th century, and more effectively, British naval incursions in the 19th century. The maritime trade with Hindustan, Southeast Asia, East Africa, and later Western Europe gave rise to the Persian Gulf as a vital alternative to the overland Central Asian trade with northern China, or to the Mediterranean and Black Sea routes in the northwest. Since late antiquity, The Persian Gulf had been incorporated into the maritime trade of the south, reaching the western shores of the Indian subcontinent and southern Arabia as far south as Yemen. Lack of forests along the Persian Gulf coasts did, though, handicap Iran's naval predominance in the region. Before the arrival of the European maritime powers, the Persian Gulf trade thus relied mostly on the Omani and Sindhi seafarers. Being in the global arid zone, Iran is deprived of substantial rainfall at lower elevations, except for a narrow strip of the Caspian coast. In the Iranian interiors, the most significant feature shaping the human habitat has been the narrow margin for survival between topographic and climatic extremes. Of the 636,296 square miles of today's Iran, close to half is mountain and desert. Of the remaining 50%, less than 15% is cultivated. Another 15% is potentially arable, 10% is forest and woodland, and the remaining 10% is pasture. The mountainous regions, both on the periphery and throughout the plateau, are sparsely populated. The desert plains of central Iran, separating Khorasan and the southeastern provinces from western Iran, are dotted by agricultural oases and small towns on the internal trade routes that connect them to large population centers on the margins of deserts and foothills of mountain ranges. It has always been a challenge for any central government to hold sway over deserts or the high mountains in the center or on the periphery. The horizontal and perpendicular dictates of the Iranian landscape, the deserts and the mountains, are further augmented by the limits of temperature and climate, and even more so by the scarcity of accessible water resources, perhaps the single most important contributor to sustainable life on the plateau. Although the annual rainfall on the plains does not exceed 12 inches, there are wide local vacillations. While the deserts and the Persian Gulf littoral receive only 5 inches on average, the Caspian littoral has an annual rainfall of 40 to 60 inches. Heavy snowfalls on the mountain peaks, at least before recent global climate changes, served as the principal source of water for irrigation of the plains. The changing of the seasons is precise, with the Persian festival Nowruz announcing spring and the ancient feast of Mehrigan declaring the coming of autumn. Though most of the central plains on the Iranian plateau have a predictable seasonal climate, temperature throughout the plateau at any time of the year can vary by as widely as 40 degrees Celsius. These factors further condition human habitats, whether nomadic, agrarian, or urban, to clusters largely on the low-elevation foothills and mountain slopes, and in the adjacent fertile plains on the edge of the desert, where drainage from the surrounding ridges is just enough to allow for irrigated cultivation, dry farming, and seasonal pasturing at higher altitudes. In contrast to the river valleys of Egypt, Mesopotamia, and elsewhere, Iranian river valleys historically played less of a role in the country's food production. Instead, there was heavy reliance on the laborious hydrological marvel of subterranean water recovery. The Ghanat, or Ghariz, sustainable water system, a Persian invention with wide usage from Japan to Morocco, was an ingenious water delivery system employed throughout the central Iranian plains, before the days of deep well and river dam technologies. The subterranean canal, some as long as 30 miles, connected numerous shafts from the mountain slopes, where water was in abundance, to the thirsty plains, where it could irrigate agricultural land and keep inhabitants of towns and villages alive. Yet it could sustain only a limited population in any given locale. In areas with access to shallow aquifers, lifting water by beasts of burden was an alternative to Ghanat. Thus, availability of water largely determined the geographical distribution of nearly 30,000 villages and hamlets throughout the Iranian landscape, where the aridity of the wilderness sharply contrasted to the precious vegetation of a controlled environment. Moreover, water explained the feasibility of the growth of major Iranian cities at strategic crossroads at the edges of watered plains, where a fertile cluster of villages in the hinterlands would supply the cities with food. The cities were connected to one another within and outside the plateau via a network of caravan routes, which passed through strings of smaller market towns, villages, and oases. Within this web of urban, rural, and pastoral habitats, each unit preserved a fair degree of subsistence, but also maintained a delicate interdependence with the whole. The Isfahan region, with a metropolis at its heart, is but one example. With a well-irrigated network of villages and farmlands in its hinterland, a vast trade network stretching in all directions, and the nomadic Bakhtiyardi territory in its vicinity, Isfahan clearly demonstrates interdependence among the urban, rural, and nomadic forms of habitat in a delicate ecological system. As much as the cities held administrative, commercial, and cultural sway over the countryside, they accounted for only a small fraction of the total population. By the 1900s, the urban population of Iran was no more than 10% of the total population of 9 million to 10 million. The vast numbers of villages, in contrast, which contained the bulk of the sedentary population, perhaps as much as 50% before the end of the 19th century, were the most vulnerable and economically impoverished sector of the population. Although villages were not bound by serfdom, and there was a fair amount of self-governance within villages, as well as freedom of mobility to other regions, the ancient agrarian regime overseeing the sharecropping system allowed absentee landlords to control the means of agricultural production and a substantial share of the crop, usually three-fifths, leaving the peasants to subsist at best and starve at worst. With the demise, or rather the impoverishment, of the Persian Degan class, the closest equivalent is the English gentry, in the early Islamic centuries, Iran's villages and the land around them often came to be squeezed between the urban elites and the tribal landlords. By means of resistance, peasants' moves from one village to another were not uncommon, nor was a switch between agrarian and pastoral modes of subsistence. Far more mobile than the peasantry and less subordinate to the city, the tribal pastoralists constituted probably as much as 40% of the Iranian population at the turn of the 20th century. Their nomadic or semi-sedentary life in regions generally beyond irrigated lands dictated a subsistent, at times harsh, lifestyle that largely relied on herding. Yet their use of pastures in the vicinity caused clashes with the sedentary population and disrupted trade, especially during seasonal migrations. Consisting of smaller kinship units within the fluid confederacy of a tribe, the participating sub-tribes shared a common language and ethnicity, even though some confederacies, such as the Khamseh, meaning consisting of five in Fars province, were of diverse origins. The vast territories under tribal control were virtually off-limits to the state's direct jurisdiction, and governments invariably appointed or endorsed leaders of the tribes from within the tribal elite. At times, strong governments also broke up tribes, organized new ones, or removed and incorporated clans into existing tribes at will for reasons of domestic security and defense of the frontiers. Numerous Kurdish tribes of the northwest were settled along Iran's northeastern borders to safeguard against Uzbek and Turkmen raids during the 17th and 18th centuries. The tribes depended on the cities as venues for offering their livestock and animal products for sale and replenishing their supplies, but also to seek allies in the conflicts with rival tribes or to prevail in internecine power struggles. The tribes' flexible superstructure, however, neither diminished their patriarchal ethos nor sapped their military potency. Major tribes on the northern Iranian periphery, at least from the mid-Safavid period, were Turkish-speaking, such as the Shaseven of Azerbaijan, or Kurdish. The Turkmens, such as the Yamut and Koklan, roamed the northeastern periphery, whereas the tribes on the southern periphery were largely Arab and Baluch. In the interior, the major tribal formations mostly were of Iranian stock, such as the Bakhtiari of Isfahan and Khuzestan, and the Lur of Zagros. But these were powerful Turkish-speaking confederacies, such as the Kashkai of Fars province. The tribal mosaic, however, seldom determined lines of political loyalty, especially at times of domestic crisis or war. Before the conscription army of the 20th century, the tribes were the backbone of Iran's fighting force, and the presence of tribal regiments of different ethnicities in the dynastic armies of the Safavid and post-Safavid periods was the norm. The armies of Nader Shah in the middle of the 18th century, for example, included numerous Turkish, Kurdish, Afghan, Turkmen, and Lur contingents. The irregular forces, as these tribal fighters are often identified in Western sources, were always mounted, and since the 17th century increasingly equipped with firearms, mostly light muskets, the weapon of choice for which the tribesmen of Iran developed an enormous fascination, almost a love affair. The use of firearms decidedly increased the potency and versatility of tribal forces, but it did not essentially change their tactics. The ancient Persian offensive-defensive warfare, Jang va Gariz, which Xenophon survived to describe in his Anabasis from the 4th century BC, still was characteristic of the sorties of the Iranian horsemen in their encounters with modern armies in the early 19th century. The required contingents of tribal horsemen summoned by the state were assembled annually to take part in seasonal military expeditions in exchange for partial payment of taxes. Facing modern European armies, though, the Iranian tribesmen no longer had a military edge. By the early part of the 20th century, they were almost completely subdued by the centralizing state. Persian city and its inhabitants. A typical city of the Iranian plateau was an enclosed oasis developed as much by the dictates of the environs as by the necessities of cultivation, trade, and the military, a combination that explained the survival of these cities against many odds, as well as their recovery after natural or human-induced calamities. Connected through a web of caravan routes, they preserved some economic sovereignty, cultural urbanity, political prominence, and ethnic diversity. Surrounded by high walls of thick mud breaks with ramparts, moats, ditches, and other fortifications, the multiple gated cities controlled not only against illicit traffic, but also against hostile forces, be they bandits, marauding nomads, or invading armies. A limited and often crowded space divided into many wards, the city was dominated by two structures at the center, the citadel, Arg, or the government headquarters and residence, and the bazaar, or the commercial and manufacturing quarter. Complementing the state and the commercial sectors was often the mosque in the center, representing the moral authority of Islam. Numerous other mosques in each neighborhood, moreover, reflected the self-sufficiency of urban wards. Mosques functioned not as mere sacred spaces, but as gathering places to socialize or to stage protests. Similar to the nomads of the countryside and in villages, patriarchy was the prevailing form of social organization in the cities. Most city quarters consisted of a number of extended families and men of authority, property, and influence, collectively known as notables, ayan, who controlled the city wards. These men wielded influence not only in the affairs of their own wards and in the politics and economy of their city and its environs, they also constituted the backbone of the bureaucracy at the regional level and even in the central government. As in the rest of the Middle East, Iranian urban patricians were of diverse origin and social status, but unlike European nobility, they were not always distinguished from the rest of society by blood and hereditary privileges. They were mostly large landowners of urban or tribal origin, officials in government service, large-scale merchants, and wealthy members of the religious establishment. Conservative in their social outlook and political leanings, the notables viewed themselves as pillars of stability, and, when circumstances required, instability in the city. Much of the history of urban Iran, especially during periods of unrest and the weakening of the central government, was written from the point of view of the urban notables, their internecine competitions and quarrels, vested interests, political patronage, and control of economic markets. At times, even the rise of one dynasty and the fall of another was not so much the outcome of the overriding might of one powerful tribal leader as it was the support of the patricians for one side against another. The rise of the Qajar dynasty at the end of the 18th century is one example. The influence of the notables over the city folks, and especially over the urban vigilantes, known as the lutis, occasionally turned city thoroughfares into violent scenes of conflict between neighboring wards. Fortified by walls, at the heart of the city was the citadel, Arg, originally a fortified military camp in pre-Islamic Iran. The seat of city's government housed the governor, his ministers and officials, and the army barracks. The citadel was often located on a hillside or higher grounds overlooking the city, symbolic of the government's defiant presence and its uneasy dealings with the urban folk. Yet it could not remain entirely isolated. The Arg complex was populated by soldiers, servants, officials, and retainers who had their ties to the city, and it was served by a string of traders, physicians, artisans, urban officials, village bailiffs, and tax collectors. The ties to the populace were too numerous to be easily severed, a fact that explains the government's limitations in enforcing absolute control. Affairs of the government, at least insofar as involved city notables, were to be settled through negotiation, persuasion, and token punishment rather than sheer force. The government's interactions with city dwellers were epitomized in the shape and multifunctional nature of the public square, Meydan, a vast intermediary space in a typical Persian town that connects the citadel, the market, the mosque, and the city thoroughfares. An old Persian urban concept with wide usage throughout the Islamic world and beyond, the Meydan, literally the space in the middle, was the closest equivalent to the Roman circus and the English commons. In this public square, the government displayed its might through military parades and playing polo, a game of Persian origin designed to show the physical fitness and riding skills of the Shah and other royalty, as well as the staging of public performances during national and religious festivals, public executions of rebels, and the flogging of hoarders and profiteers. For the people, the public square was a gathering place to celebrate, protest, and mourn, to receive and send off caravans, to trade their goods and beasts of burden, and even to camp. The communal function of the Meydan is evident through its close relationship with another major Persian urban institution, the bazaar. Entering the European vocabulary through the Portuguese language, the word bazaar in Old Persian meant a gathering place of both humans and for the sale of domestic animals, comparable to the Greek agora. Located typically on the opposite end of the citadel, the bazaar served as the commercial, financial, and manufacturing centre of the city. A vast network of shops, wholesale trading houses, caravanserais, storage houses, workshops, and small industries, the bazaar, often a roofed space, housed guilds and professions in separate clusters along the arteries and side alleys. Such coexistence in a confined space may not have engendered entrepreneurial competition, but it did encourage professional solidarity and, in times of crisis, defiance. Organized in guilds with designated leadership, the merchants, traders, and manufacturers of the bazaar constituted one of the most coherent sectors of the society. The large-scale merchants, Tojjar, dominated the trade and finances of the bazaar, as well as its political orientation and loyalty. They were an indigenous equivalent of a bourgeoisie with a strong capitalist ethos, but in contrast to their European counterparts, they were often introverted in their private lives and pious in negotiating an Islamic mercantile ethics. Yet, in times of crisis, they did not hesitate to incite the bazaar to protest, often against government intervention in the market. Because of its economic muscle and its professional cohesion, the bazaar remained an integral part of the political process all through the modern period, demonstrating its power not only through control of the market, but also by backing the ulama and other pressure groups, bribing officials, and staging protests and shutdowns, the latter often being a weapon of great potency. The caravan, from the Persian term for army logistics, the quintessential Persian method of transportation, was the bazaar's long commercial arm extending across the wilderness to markets in other cities. A train of pack animals, usually double-humped Khorasan camels, a sturdy crossbreed between Arabian and Central Asian species, was the most practical and cost-efficient method for the overland movement of goods, operating through caravan routes at a slow but steady pace, and relying on a support network of caravanserais throughout the landscape of the Iranian plateau. The criss-crossing caravan network also served as an information network, bringing news from distant lands, a mix of fact and fiction retold by caravanners and pilgrims, which in pre-modern times was city residents' source of information about a larger community beyond the confines of their own city or village.